Hello, and welcome to the Popmatic Podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Crystal. We're librarians at Nashville Public Library.
This podcast is where you can find reviews and recommendations of the best books, movies, and music available for checkout from the Popular Materials Department of the Nashville Public Library.
You can also learn about library programs such as concerts, film screenings, book clubs, author talks, and book signings.
This is where we talk about music that we like.
I can't believe you listened to that.
Sometimes it can take years before you understand a classic. I'd given the Stooges' Funhouse a few spins in the past, only to be left scratching my head. This time around, the deities of Detroit rock rang my bell, and rang it hard. Released in 1970, Funhouse bridges the gap between the psychedelic garage rock found on the popular Nuggets box set and the punk proper that emerged later in the mid-70s. The Stooges introduced Iggy Pop to the world. His confrontational delivery, a gut-punch combo of yelps, howls, and grunts, are as immediate and exhilarating as the best punk rock. Though the tempos are slower than the more extreme genres that would evolve later, the Stooges are unrivaled in their intensity and abandon. Here's a bit of the song TVI. Ron Astin's guitar is like a razor on that track. Iggy had definitely been listening to The Doors, but another influence is John Coltrane. As Iggy later confessed, he had a lot of sophisticated ideas, but he and his band did not have a lot of technique. This leads to some interesting results on Funhouse. The band brought in Steve McKay to play saxophone. My favorite moments are when I assume they are attempting jazz rock improvisation, and instead were treated to an atonal no-wave avalanche. On the track L.A. Blues, the band demonstrates a very liberal definition of blues. When they played that song live, they called it their hippie ending. The summer of love had apparently soured. Etching the blueprint for punk, no wave, skronk, countless less is more garage bands, and the spazzed out freak jazz of the New York scene, Funhouse is a landmark, powerhouse of an album. Maybe Crystal has something a little bit more melodic to showcase.
I think so. I've been listening to OUR's third record, Mercy, Dancing for the Death of an Imaginary Enemy, which came out in April of this year, but not until after OUR's went through several label changes. For more info on the music business drama, there's a great interview with Jimmy Necco posted on rockinworld.com. Who is Jimmy Necco? Jimmy is the mastermind behind OUR's. He wrote all the songs and co-produced Mercy with legendary producer Rick Rubin. Let's jump in and give your ears a taste with a track called Black. I love that he can sing a line so beautiful and melodic, then in the next measure wail like a banshee. Jimmy's voice has long been compared to the late Jeff Buckley's. Let it be said that no one can ever equal Jeff, but Jimmy Necco has a vocal strength all his own. At the end of Black, he goes off on a spoken rant that should have been edited out, but don't hold that against the rest of the record. Let's listen to a cut from another tune called Saint.
And we'll grieve the ones who didn't make it, and we'll grieve.
That's a power ballad and a half, huh? The rest of Mercy is a nice mix of pop and rock, even some dance and trance. Jimmy grew up listening to U2, and you can hear edge-like guitar riffs, especially during the tunes Worst Things Beautiful and Willing. Jimmy said in an interview that working with Rick Rubin was a good experience. Rick doesn't go to the studio. That's not how he works. The band went to his house before recording the record. Jimmy played the songs for him on an acoustic guitar, and they arranged them right there in his library. What a life.
Sometime we'll have to compare the librarian lifestyle to the rock and roll lifestyle. But until then, here are Julie and Amanda with some really great book recommendations.
I can't believe you read that.
Believe it. This is Amanda and Julie, and we're back with some great new reads. Tag Julie, you're it.
Thanks, Amanda. Now here's a unique twist. A private investigator with Tourette syndrome. Motherless Brooklyn by Jonathan Lethem is told in the first person by a native Brooklynite who is trying to solve a crime and in the process uncovers a devastating personal betrayal. His name is Lionel Esrog, and he suffers from uncontrollable tics, outbursts, and odd compulsions. Having grown up as a misfit at St. Vincent's Home for Boys, he's now a detective who works for Frank Minna, along with several other guys who refer to themselves as the Minna Men. When they were teenagers, Frank Minna began to pick them up from the home to work day jobs for his moving company. It's an apparently shady enterprise. Minna became sort of a father figure to Lionel, and as an adult, Lionel continued working for him, learning not to ask any questions and to do as he was told, but grateful to have a purpose. When Minna is killed, Lionel begins an investigation into what happened and why. If any book is a must-listen rather than a must-read, this is it. The narrator, Frank Muller, does a wonderful job portraying someone struggling to control his Tourette's outbursts. Also, the author's ability to evoke feelings and atmosphere is such that by the end of the story, I was seriously ready to travel to JFK Airport just to get a particular kosher sandwich that is described in detail. Here's a snippet to give you a flavor of the audiobook, a scene in which Lionel and one of his cohorts are eating hamburgers in a car during a stakeout.
Now he nudged the bag of White Castles in my direction on the car seat, crinkling the paper. Stuff in your hole. Coney didn't rate any special consideration from me. Eat me, eat me, eat me! I shrieked again, letting off more of the pressure in my head. Then I was able to concentrate. I helped myself to one of the tiny burgers. Unwrapping it, I lifted the top of the bun to examine the grid of holes in the patty, the slime of glistening cubed onions. This was another compulsion. I always had to look inside a White Castle to appreciate the contrast of machine-tooled burger and nubbin of fried goo. Chaos and control.
After listening to this one, I wanted more of the self-deprecating Lionel Esrog, but Motherless Brooklyn does not have a sequel. I did learn that Jonathan Lethem is an extremely versatile writer. His other books have been described as surreal futuristic noirs, post-apocalyptic road novels, and hilarious academic parodies. I look forward to reading some of those.
Wow, Julie, I might have to read that one myself.
Well, I think you should. What have you been reading?
Today, I'm going to discuss Donald McCaig's Gone with the Wind rewrite entitled Rhett Butler's People. Now, in the efforts of full disclosure, I must admit that I am a huge Gone with the Wind fan. I read the epic tome for the first time in fourth grade, and I've been in love with it ever since. I've even read most, if not all, of the ensuing companion books, including the much maligned sequel written by Alexandra Ripley simply called Scarlet, as well as The Wind Done Gone by Alice Randall, which was Mitchell's story retold from an African-American perspective. So I was very excited when I found out that someone had released a tale written from Rhett's point of view. For the most part, I enjoyed reading this book. It did take about 100 pages or so for me to find the Rhett Butler that I grew up with, but he's in there. I'm going to have to go back and reread Gone with the Wind again, because I know it's different from the movie in parts, and I think that some of McCaig's differences probably match the book and not the movie. Here's a brief excerpt from McCaig's book so you can see what I'm talking about. As Melanie Wilkes was dying, Rhett Butler waited in the parlor of his mansion on Peachtree Street, listening to the clock. It was October, a dark, drizzly afternoon. Rhett didn't care. The clock chimed the hour, 6 funeral strokes. A gust in the room ruffled the hair on the back of his neck, and Rhett knew Miss Melly was dead. Melanie Wilkes was one of the few creatures Rhett had ever known who would not be deceived. Had he loved Scarlet, or had he loved what she might become? Had he deceived himself, loving the image more than the flesh and blood woman? Rhett didn't care. If she had betrayed him again and again with Ashley Wilkes, Rhett didn't care. Ashley was free now. If she still wanted the man, she could have him. That evening, when Rhett's wife came home from Melanie Wilkes' deathbed, she told her husband she loved him. Scarlet had never said that before, and Rhett may have believed her, but he didn't care. Rhett Butler looked into the pale green eyes that had mesmerized him for so many years, and did not give a good gosh darn. Okay, that last part was edited for sensitive ears, but y'all know where he was going. Could diehard fans rip McKeag's interpretation apart? Sure, and some have. Scarlet fans should also be warned that McKeag totally deviates from Ripley's ending and creates one of his own. But, as my family says, you can either analyze it, or you can enjoy it. Me? I'm just going to enjoy it and take it for what it is, and I'd recommend that you do the same. Because frankly, my dears, nothing will ever be as great as the original. Now we're going to turn things over to Bill, who has a great interview with film scholar Tim Lucas.
I can't believe you watched that.
I'm William Chamberlain of the Popular Materials Department. For this edition of I Can't Believe You Watched That, we're featuring a brief chat with Tim Lucas about his new book on David Cronenberg's film Videodrome. For those not in the know, Tim is a film critic, writer, and publisher of the video review magazine Video Watchdog. The library has his novel, The Book of Renfield, A Gospel of Dracula, for checkout, and you can place your request for Videodrome, which is on order for our collection. Don't miss our final Thursday Night of Terror on October 30th, when you'll see the video introduction Tim graciously recorded for Mario Bava's chiller, Black Sunday. And now, here's Mr. Lucas.
Long ago, I wrote a feature article for Cine Fantastique about the making of Videodrome. I took a year of my life to write the whole story of the making of this film based on 2 weeks that I spent on the set. Then when it came time for the article to go into print, the movie came out, my editor went on his honeymoon during that period, and when he got back, the movie had already closed. It was a huge commercial disaster. So they said, well, we're not going to do the double issue on Videodrome anymore, so we're going to wait until The Dead Zone comes out, David Cronenberg's next picture. And then we're going to do a double issue on those two films together. So you've got to go up and visit the set of The Dead Zone and write about that, too. Well, I wasn't too happy about that, because I'm not the biggest Stephen King fan in the world. So I had to read Dead Zone and start researching that. But I visited the set there of the Dead Zone for like 2 days and came back and started writing that. Make a long, long story short, when it came time for that issue to come out, my editor was having cold feet about devoting an issue to Cronenberg since his last picture didn't do well. He thought maybe the Dead Zone wouldn't do well because the Stephen King movies in general weren't doing well at that time. I think Carrie was the only hit. So he said, we're going to do a single issue devoted to the two films. Well, that's fine, except I got paid by the word, which means he cut out like a lot of words. So what I'd spent all that time writing, I wasn't really getting paid for. And when the issue came out, I disowned it because they had to cut it down so much that they actually couldn't keep my own words in butchered form. They actually had to rewrite or paraphrase everything I had written. So I was furious, and I had been with them for like 11 years, but I quit. I refused to work for them again after that. And so all this time later, this guy with this company, Millipede Press, approached me and said, I want to introduce a series of books called Studies in the Horror Film. And do you have anything that you'd like to contribute? And I said, well, I do have this book already on Videodrome. We could just slap that right in. I told him I had all these original photos that we took on the set that had never been published. And as it turns out, not too many of those are going to be in the book, just because it has to be a certain length to fit the format that they wanted to use. But I can put some more up on my blog and help to promote it when it comes out. But it is longer than the book that he wanted to publish. I think it's like 160 or 180 pages rather than 140. But it's turned out very well. I went through the original manuscript and updated it. I wrote sort of new, bringing the subject up to date chapter, and writing about, you know, contemporary films like Vacancy and things like that, which have a certain debt to Videodrome and its place in the whole torture porn controversy. So I think it's a pretty interesting book, and I'm really relieved that it's finally going to be coming out.
Special thanks to Andrew Thompson, who has a big voice and an even bigger heart. Everyone on the web team, Clint Tatum, audio engineer extraordinaire. And last but not least, Adam Wicked Licks Dean.
You've been listening to Nashville Public Library's Pop-Matic Podcast. For more information, please visit library.nashville.org.
That's on the interweb.